Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
They arrived in their longships. They were in, they murdered. They took prisoners. They took away all the wealth. In this podcast, we're travelling to a place stained with the first bloody fingerprints of an invader who would change the British Isles forever. A tidal island that by 635 AD was home to a thriving priory, growing rich and famous around the world, robbed and destroyed with fierce brutality. Eventually rebuilt in the 10th century before being plundered and erased for good by Henry VIII. A beautiful island, tucked away out of sight. It's hard to imagine that it's a place that's been party to so much of the history that has shaped these British Isles. I'm stepping out across Britain to discover 100 remarkable places that have shaped you, me, and the whole world. I'm Neil Oliver, and this is my love letter to the British Isles.
Hi Neil. Last week we climbed the battlements of Bamburgh Castle and went in search of the legendary King Arthur. Where are we this week?
This time we're heading to an island that you can actually see from the battlements of Bamburgh Castle. It's magical. It involves a walk across a long tidal causeway. So you have to time it right or you'll literally be swept out to sea. It's home to a ransacked abbey and a romantic castle. It's a place with two names. It's the Holy Island and it's Lindisfarne.
Can you give me a sort of detailed description of what it's like to get there?
It's a good point, actually, Paul. If you've never been, it's hard to visualise, actually. It's quite a strange place. It's a tidal island, Lindisfarne, which is to say that it's connected at low tide by a causeway to the mainland. And then at high tide, that causeway is flooded and Lindisfarne becomes completely cut off. So that's a tidal island. So it's in this cycle of belonging to the being part of the mainland and then being cut off. And it comes and it goes with the tide, which adds an air of adventure. Because if you're going to go, you've got to time it right. You've got to pay attention to tide tables and get there at the right time of day for the tides, otherwise the causeway's flooded. And likewise, if you make the crossing to Lindisfarne and you don't pay attention to the time and you haven't booked somewhere to stay, then you'll get cut off, you know, for hours. So it's important, and it adds an air of kind of Swallows and Amazons drama to the whole affair. It's very close, obviously, to the mainland. The causeway, which you can drive across in your car, is just about a mile long, dead straight, which is just slightly raised up above the mud flats, the sand, the wet sand. So it's always a bit wet. Even when the tide's out, you're in no doubt that you're travelling over sandbars and whatever to get to Lindisfarne. So it's exciting. Viewed from above, Lindisfarne's, it's an odd shape of a thing. There's a main lump of it, which is where the little village is and where the castle is and where the abbey is. And then there's also this I always think of it as being like, if you imagine a bit of chewing gum that someone stretched a bit out. So there's this long, thin stretch with a tiny little clump nearest to the mainland. That's called the Snook. That's actually the first bit that you arrive at when you come across the causeway by car. But that's not the only way to go to Lindisfarne. Even better, there's always been a pilgrim's path. And that's a 3 mile long walk that's marked across the sand by tall wooden poles. Dead straight, easy to do. But if it's important to pay attention to the tide tables when you're going across the causeway in your car, it's literally a matter of life and death if you were going to do the walk. Because the tide, as is always the case in these places, the tide comes in when it does very, very quickly. Faster than you can run. So if you're out in the middle, if you're foolish and you just wander out at any old time, if the tide comes in, you'll end up swimming. And you're also caught in a quite a powerful current. So it's dangerous. But if you pay attention and if you take some local advice, you can walk the 3 miles. And that's the way that traditionally Christian pilgrims would have always approached the holy island of Lindisfarne. Long before there was anything but being on foot or being on horseback, this is the way that people would have approached it. And that's definitely the best way. Because it's very flat, obviously, because you're walking across the seabed. And Lindisfarne depends on the light. It's very variable, obviously. You're off the northeast coast of England. So the weather's very variable, obviously. But quite often, there's all sorts of combinations of light and mist. You can get all sorts of like, optical illusions. And for the longest time, when you're walking the Pilgrim's Way to Lindisfarne, it appears very far away. I always think of it looking like a length of green rope laid on the sand. Because Lindisfarne, the island, it doesn't sit up very high, not really. So it's got this very low to the sea profile. And then you can see the bump where there's a castle. There's a castle on Lindisfarne as well, and you can sort of see that as well. So it's got a magical, mysterious look. And we talked when we were at Bamburgh Castle, about Arthur and Avalon. And the sense of Lindisfarne looking like an Avalon is very strong. There's a real air of magic and mystery. So it's one of the places in this love letter to the British Isles that's made special by the journey. Iona's another one. The other, you know, coincidentally, the other holy island is a magical mystery adventure to get to involving fairies and all sorts. And likewise, Lindisfarne, which is on the eastern seaboard, bookending the British Isles, two holy islands, one either side. Then likewise, but in a different way, the journey to Lindisfarne is also special. And when you go, you can stay. You know, there's limited accommodation because it's only small. And that's brilliant, you know, to go across and know that you're about to be marooned. You're about to be castaways. That in itself just makes it worth visiting. During the summertime, it can be very busy with day trippers, obviously. It's a great place to go. But if you wait until all those people have to leave, because if they've got nowhere to stay, they've got to get off the island. And when they leave, you can almost feel the island exhaling. You can almost feel it breathing out, a sigh of relief. And there you are, you've got the place to yourself, if you like. Because there's, apart from the people who are permanent residents, there simply won't be that many people staying on Lindisfarne.
It's a very dramatic and windswept coast, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it can be. It can be, you know, because it's the sea and it can be wild and the weather can come in and it can get stormy and it can be blown a hoolie. But that's all just part of the pleasure of being there. But of course, it is one of the holy isles. Now, a lot of people have very strong opinions about religion and Christianity or whatever. And you know, there's a lot of people who are and declare themselves to be atheists, which is fair enough. But Christian or not, going there and knowing the story of Christianity there is also part of what makes it special. But even if you're the most avowed atheist, it's still interesting to know the Christian story, because that's so much of what Lindisfarne is all about. We've mentioned, we talked about it in relation to Lullingston Roman Villa, and Iona, the Christian religion came into the British Isles with Rome during the time of the Roman occupation. Rome was originally, pagan, during the time of the conquest of Britain. But during the 300s, during the early part of the 4th century AD, the Emperor Constantine stopped the persecution of Christians, which had been a blood sport for all up until that point. The Christians were severely put upon, but Constantine had some kind of conversion before his significant battle, before he became emperor at Milvian Bridge. On the way to Rome, he apparently saw a cross in the clouds and saw or understood the message: if you put this sign on your soldiers, you'll be victorious, which he duly did. And that's the legend. That's how he comes to be Christian. And from that point on, Rome was tolerant of Christianity. And historians have always argued whether Constantine really was Christian in his heart, because the Roman emperors, they're political people. And a lot of the things, maybe most of the things they did, were out of political expediency. And he may just have seen that Christianity was the coming thing, that it was on the rise. And perhaps he just wanted it inside the tent, peeing out, rather than outside the tent, peeing in. And he maybe just saw it as another way to win favour with another chunk of population. But there are stories that he learned Christianity at his mother's knee. And his mother was called Helena, and she was she was an innkeeper's daughter from a place called Nisus on the Danube, and she was obviously married to his father, who was Constantius Chlorus, who was emperor before him. So there's always been a tradition as well that he was Christian, that he genuinely was. But in any event. The Roman Empire took the decision to become tolerant of Christianity, and while the Romans were in Britain, as we saw at Lullingston Roman Villa down in the southeast, Christianity just came in, just kind of drifted in like a sea mist, if you like. Pilgrims, churchmen, early Christians started coming in. And all the while, during the centuries of the Roman occupation, Christianity was safe in Britain. And it took firm hold. But then, during the 400s, during the 5th century, Rome had problems of its own. They pulled their legions out of Britannia. And when these islands were left alone, the people who had been Christian showed themselves to be backsliders, a lot of them. And these, they'd obviously still remembered the pagan ways of their forefathers. And without the Romans there to keep it Christian, a lot of them went back to their old pagan ways. And once again, as it had been before, it became difficult for Christians. And Christianity was discouraged, and it became difficult. And it was pushed to the fringes. So, down into Cornwall, across into Ireland, which had never been dominated properly by Rome. And then in the west coast of Scotland, Christianity clung on like stubborn ivy holding on to the outside of a building. And it was important, actually, that Ireland was never Romanised in the way that the rest of Britannia was, because it meant that the Christian faith that took root there, and Christian fathers had got into Ireland the same way they'd got into everywhere else, it grew as a kind of a variant form of the same plant. It was different, like with all faiths, like with Islam and Christianity. There are different sects of it. Different people within the faith have different ideas about how best to do it. And the Irish Celtic form was a style all its own. And then after the century or so, when Christianity was almost lost in the British Isles and elsewhere, when it began to be being reseeded, when Christianity began to spread back in large part, it was this Irish Celtic form that came back in. The other more sort of Roman Christianity was also there, but there was the Irish Celtic form as well. And it was that unique and individual style of Christianity that started to drift back in. And it was Irish Christianity that arrived in Iona with St. Columba. Now, one of the Anglo-Saxon kings who had been Christianized was Oswald. And we mentioned Oswald in relation to Bamburgh when we were doing a love letter from Bamburgh Castle. Oswald was the king of Northumbria. And when he came into his kingship, he brought with him a monk from Iona called Aidan, later remembered as Saint Aidan. And because Oswald had Northumbria, he gave Aidan Lindisfarne. In the same way that Columba was given Iona on the west to develop a monastery there, on the east side in Northumbria, King Oswald gave Aidan Lindisfarne and said, you know, have your base of operations there.
And what was Oswald's connection to Iona?
Well, Oswald, he was in exile for a while. A lot of these kings, the story of the Anglo-Saxon kings, it's so violent, you know, and a lot of the claimants on thrones, they're in exile for periods, and then when they figure the time is right, or when the right person dies, and you know, vacates a throne, you know, they'll take a chance at coming back to reclaim their kingship. For a while, Oswald was on Iona. He was, because he was Christian, he was in exile there, so he knew Aidan, so by the time he came back into Northumbria from Iona, he had friends, Christian friends, and Aidan was one of them. So he brought him with him. And Northumbria was Christian before Oswald anyway. There was a king before him who was Oswald's father, who was King Edwin. And there's a lovely story about him, the Venerable Bede. And he wrote his own history of the British Isles, you know, paying particular attention to all things Christian because he was a churchman. He was based in the northeast. And he wrote down the legend that King Edwin was the one who was converted from the pagan way of life to Christianity. And he was having Christianity pitched at him by, you know, sort of door-to-door salesmen, you know, were knocking on his door, suggesting to him that, you know, he might like to contemplate converting to Christianity. And he was a thoughtful person, and he took advice from his lords, you know, his men around him, his fighting men. And one of them, famously, according to the Venerable Bede, said, "Life is like a banquet hall. Inside is light and fire and warmth and feasting, but outside it is cold and dark. A sparrow flies in through a window at one end, flies the length of the hall, and out through a window at the other end. This is what life is like. At birth, we emerge from the unknown, and for a brief while we are here on this earth with a fair amount of comfort and happiness. But then we fly out into the cold and dark and unknown future. If this new religion can lighten that darkness for us, then let us follow it." Now, it's all very poetic and beautiful, but apparently Edwin took this advice, thought it made sense. Why not? Why not hedge your bets? Why not convert to Christianity? Because it was offering life after death. It was offering the possibility of continued warmth, you know, rather than just having the warmth of happiness while you're briefly alive. Christianity offered eternal life and eternal happiness. And so quite rightly, a lot of people were thinking, well, why not? That sounds like a good offer. So in any event, you've got Oswald on the throne of Northumberland at that time, and he brings in St. Aidan from Iona, and there's a Christian priory is established on Lindisfarne in 635 AD. And Aidan sounds like an interesting character. It was said that he always walked if he could. He was very reluctant even to get on horseback. You know, it was all part of his, I suppose, the idea that, you know, as a Christian, there's an element of suffering and enduring hardship. And so he walked everywhere. And so it's easy to imagine that he would have been one of those who followed the pilgrim's way, who walked the 3 miles across the sand to this place. And in exactly the same way as Iona, if you go to Lindisfarne, it's the place that suggests by itself that it's already sacred, in that way that certain places in the world are just made special by the hand of natural elements. They're just better than everywhere else. Some way in which the light and the landscape and the weather, the way in which all of the elements combine in certain little pockets, just, they declare those places worthwhile. sacred, holy, so that when people come with a new version of holiness, like Christianity was the new, they were the new kids on the block, and you get the distinct feeling in a place like Lindisfarne that when they arrived, they would know, yes, this is a place that's already touched by something holy. And this is therefore the right place for us to embed our idea, which is Christianity. You know, Lindisfarne is just one of those places. And so the Christianity takes root there, and it grows, and it does it. It's not just any old Christian centre. It becomes one of the brightest lights in all of Christendom. The priory, the Christian community on Lindisfarne becomes one of the most significant places for Christians in the entire world. And it's obviously there's the Lindisfarne Gospels, which is a version of the four Gospels of the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. And the Lindisfarne Gospels are associated with the island. They may have been written on Lindisfarne. It's hard to tell now, but they're very much associated with Lindisfarne. You know, at least some of the work of the creation of them seems to have been done on that island. And so, although it's a place on the edge now, out on the fringes, overlooked by most, this is an opportunity to invite yourself to think about times when other places mattered. You know, forget your Londons and forget your Manchesters, your Belfasts and your Glasgows. You know, for a while, Lindisfarne, that was the place. That was the brightest light, literally and metaphorically, and it was drawing people from all over. The most famous of all the characters, you know, Iona has its Columba. Well, Lindisfarne has Cuthbert. He's by far and away the most famous saint. He was in charge of the priory from 665 AD, and he died in 687. And he lived all that time on the island. And it was said 11 years later, after he died and was buried on the island, the monks decided that they should give him a grander sarcophagus. You know, that they'd buried him in too simple a fashion, and they ought to move him to somewhere a bit more befitting a saint. And according to the legend, after 11 years, they opened his coffin and they said that his body was incorrupt, that it hadn't changed, that he still looked as if he was as perfect as he had been in the day and the hour that they put him into the ground. You know, take from that what you will.
There was great artworks as well there, weren't there?
Oh, the Lindisfarne Gospels, for example, are regarded by some people who know about such things as some of the finest art ever created by anyone anywhere. Because the Lindisfarne Gospels, although the words of Matthew, Mark, Luke and John are there, faithfully copied out, it was understood that many people were illiterate, couldn't read, and so there had to be more. So it's lavishly illustrated, so there's pictures there's pictures for people that can't read, and it's regarded as a high point, which to some extent was never surpassed. That, you know, that there's other art from other periods that's as good and as important, but nothing better in a sense. So this was the kind of atmosphere that you have to imagine prevailing on this little island. By the 9th century, which is to say by the 800s AD, it was one of the most important places in Christendom. And so inevitably, as well as attracting the attention of nice people, good people, it attracted the attention of people with more earthly desires. Vikings arrived, and the Vikings were pagan, so they didn't care a whit for the idea that this was a holy place. It meant nothing to them. And we've also mentioned before, when we've been talking, that the Vikings had quite astutely realised that these Christian people were gathering every Sunday in these special buildings. And better yet, those special buildings were full of important things, because these Christian communities, they were in the habit of, say in the case of the Lindisfarne Gospels and other holy books, they were in the habit of covering them with gold and precious jewels. And on the altars there were golden cups, you know, for the Eucharist and all the rest of it. So the Vikings knew that if they just turned up at these places, especially on a Sunday, the entire community from miles around was liable to be all in the one place. So that they could go in, round them up, take them away, sell them as slaves, and at the same time gather up all the wealth of the community at the same time. Well, one of the earliest experiments with this as a new economic business model, if you like, was at Lindisfarne. The men from Hålogaland in western Norway turned up on Lindisfarne on the 8th of June 793. We know about it explicitly and in detail because it happened on a holy island. So it involved a community, a wider community that could write. So the Vikings arrived. They arrived in their longships. They went in, they murdered, they took prisoners, they took away all the wealth. And because it was Lindisfarne, I mean, this is like, those filthy pagans could not have put their dirty hands on a more sacred place in the whole world, really, as far as the Christians were concerned. So Christians in other parts of Christian Europe wrote about it. Like the end of the world. This is literally like the end of the world. These pagan wolves, you know, have ravaged Lindisfarne and they've spilt blood in the holiest of holy places. So we know all about it. And it begins to explain, or it does explain, why the Vikings went on from that to always have this terrible reputation for violence, for raping and pillaging, because they had targeted Christians who could write. The Vikings couldn't write, so they couldn't write anything to, you know, any good publicity for themselves. So the only things that were being written about Vikings were being written about people that they were killing. Hence the bad press. But the Vikings very early had this terrible, reputation. And this was only the start of it for Christian Britain. It may not even have been the first. You know, the Vikings may have come in at other communities elsewhere, but because they arrived at Lindisfarne, that one got remembered. There may have been earlier attacks against people who couldn't write, against just some rural community somewhere on the coastline of the British Isles. It's hard to say. But after they arrived at Lindisfarne in 793 AD, they never went away again. And literally, you know, the Vikings are still among us. You know, there's Viking DNA that's marbled through the tribes of Britain. So then, having arrived at the end of the 8th century, they never go away again. And for a long time, they just keep on turning up and doing these violent things. And what it meant on Lindisfarne was, within a couple of years at most of being attacked on Lindisfarne, the Christian community just upped sticks and left. They were so tired they were so appalled by what had happened, that they upped sticks. They took the remains, the bones, the relics of St Cuthbert, and they just left Lindisfarne behind. And they wandered for years. And then eventually settled with St Cuthbert at Chesterley Street. And then eventually their descendants built the cathedral at Durham. But then by the end of the 11th century, they had come back to Lindisfarne from Durham Cathedral. And what they built then, I mean, whatever Christian community was built, say, under the time of Cuthbert or earlier, was probably quite a modest place. It wouldn't have been as terribly grand as what was then built at the end of the 11th century by the monks who had returned to the island from Durham. So it was at that point that the priory, the ruins of which are there to this day, that's when that was built. And it lasted, this lavish, large, stone-built religious building, until the dissolution of the monasteries by Henry VIII. So it lasted for centuries. But then the dissolution of the monasteries under Henry VIII, it was stripped of all its valuables, and it quickly became a building site. And it was at that point, because it was good building stone. And so what was salvaged and scavenged from the ruined monastery was used then to build the castle. And it's the castle which, to some extent, so defines Lindisfarne, funnily enough, because it gives it a very distinctive shape. The castle sits up on a crag of rock called Beeblow Crag, and then it subsequently became a ruin. And then, fascinatingly, because you turn up and you see this castle, it's like a fairy tale castle. But in actual fact, it's a bit of a confection. It was a ruin. It was left, it was ruined for centuries. And then it was acquired in the early part of the 20th century, or just about the turn of the 20th century, by Edward Hudson, who was a publisher of magazines, including Country Life magazine. So he bought the ruin. And he then asked his friend, the architect and sculptor Sir Edwin Lutyens, to rebuild a castle for him. Now, Edwin Lutyens is the sculptor who subsequently built the cenotaph, the memorial to the fallen of the First World War that's in Whitehall. Okay, so before building the cenotaph, Edwin Lutyens created this fairy tale castle for his friend on the island. So, like so many of these places, it's layer upon layer upon layer. Just as at Bamburgh Castle, you know, Bamburgh Castle's now held by the Armstrong family, but they've only had it since the end of the 19th century, turn of the 20th century. But there are, you know, centuries, millennia of history that go back. And so it is with Lindisfarne. You know, people go there to see the castle, and the castle that you see now is a modern fantasy of a castle in every meaningful sense. But then there's the ruins of the monastery, and it was built, when it was built, by people who had come from Durham. And those people were at Durham because they were the original exiles from Lindisfarne. You know, Durham Cathedral was built by the descendants of those who abandoned Lindisfarne because of the Vikings. And you've got the Viking, fingerprints there as well. And the Viking story is another of those parts. You know, we'll come to it again and again as this story unfolds. But the Vikings are part of Britain. Once they arrived in the 700s and in the early 800s, they settled, and they liked the place so much they just decided to stay. And what the Vikings eventually did, it's a bit like Kaiser Soze. It's a bit like Kaiser Soze in The Usual Suspects. You know, they managed to disappear. You know, the cleverest thing the devil ever did was persuading the world he didn't exist. The Vikings just stopped calling themselves Vikings. Eventually, the Vikings became Christianized. And very cleverly, they just began speaking the local language, wearing the local clothes, taking on the local customs. And people, after a while, forgot they were even there. So that the Vikings are just there invisibly among us. From Orkney to all over, the Vikings are one of the tribes of the British Isles. And if for no other reason, you can go to Lindisfarne, and there you find the earliest bloody fingerprints of that people there on the beach at Lindisfarne.
The island has this important and bloody history. But if you go there now, it's peace personified, isn't it?
Yes, it's strange, isn't it? All that drama and then an atrocity. What happened to the Christian community of Lindisfarne in 793 AD was nothing less than an atrocity. A gruesome horror inflicted upon unarmed people by violent attackers. And yet, obviously, the passage of time and the power of the elements, in the same way that the waves and the weather round the jagged corners off of a stone until it's a smooth pebble that's pleasant to hold in your hand. So the passage of time has had the same effect on Lindisfarne, and the drama and the violence and the sadness and the grief has all been softened and washed away. And there's no denying it is now a place of peace. And you go there and you walk across the sands for 3 miles, or you take your car across and you park up and you wander about, and it's some days on Lindisfarne it's like wandering about in a dream. There's an atmosphere that has settled in that kind of Brigadoon lost paradise sense. When the weather is just right and the day is just right and the light is just right, you feel as if you've walked into one of the anterooms of heaven itself. It's just lovely. And it's a place of peace and contemplation. Whether you have religious feelings or no religious feelings at all, there's still balm, salve for the soul to be had on Lindisfarne. I would defy anyone. You go there onto the heath and the seagrass and the beach and wander around Lindisfarne, and you will just feel the knots in your rope being untied for you, and you'll come away a better person.
Thank you.
culture and a way of life trampled underfoot by brutal invaders. The men were driven off or slaughtered in a systematic genocide. Pictish roundhouses and carved stone artworks were smashed or repurposed. A beautiful island that has seen so much, where the Vikings came, not just to plunder, but to stay. Next time, in my love letter to the British Isles. Check out my Instagram account, Neil Oliver Love Letter. And to ensure you get each new episode of the podcast as it goes live, don't forget to subscribe, write a review, and share with your friends. For further reading about these favourite destinations of mine, you could try my book. It's called The Story of the British Isles in 100 Places, and it's published by Transworld. Neil Oliver's Love Letter to the British Isles is produced by Paul Ratcliffe and Neil Oliver for Fat Belly Films. Music is by Malcolm Goldie. The social media producer is Oscar CFR. Additional research is by Evie, Lucian, Archie and Teddy. Finance is taken care of by Catherine and Trudy. Post-production is by Althorp Studios and the graphics by Paul Plowman. And special thanks to the people across history who have made and continue to make these isles such an incredible place. This has been an FBF Podcasts production.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.